You're listening to In the Drink with me, Joe Campanelli. When I'm not hosting In the Drink, you can find me at Lalu or Fausto, my restaurants here in Brooklyn, New York. I'm really excited about today's episode. We have Claire Naudin from Burgundy. Claire makes absolutely beautiful wines that you can find at both Lalu and Fausto. And one of my favorite wines that she makes is the Aligoté Le Clou 34 with some truly ancient Aligoté vines. The Aligoté grape is usually one that people don't dedicate that much attention to. There are a few growers who still grow Aligoté in Burgundy. They're enthusiasts, but very few have the sort of depth and longevity of Claire's wine. I will apologize about the audio quality today. I taped this myself. Normally we have our very talented producer, Jessamine Molly of Seaplane Armada, with us, but I wanted to catch Claire while she was in town and our schedules didn't line up. So that being said, I'm really excited for you to hear today's interview. Claire is just such a fascinating guest. I hope you enjoy. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit of your personal history of how you got started in winemaking.
Well, it was easy for me because I was born in a wine family. My father, my grandfather, and the people before were growing vines and making wine. The thing is, my father had three daughters. So to him, it was obvious that nobody would stay. And then I said, okay, maybe I can try and do something. Actually,
because in those days, daughters wouldn't take over the winery. Usually the son would take over.
And when I said, maybe I will go in, he said, okay, you just have to marry a wine grower. And I said, no, that's not what I am talking about. I'm going to do it myself. And maybe I will marry a wine grower, but actually I would prefer not to.
It reminds me actually of, I know it's a very different scale, but there's a story of Antonori in Tuscany where he had three daughters and he actually decided to sell the winery because he was so sure that his daughters wouldn't take over. And then when he realized that they could years after, he had to buy back the vineyard. Mm-hmm. So it's good that you said from an early stage and you held your ground.
Exactly.
And what years were that when you were having those conversations with your dad? Was that the late 80s, early 90s?
I was a student. Actually, I wanted to be a geologist, so I prepared the high school for that, and there was a competition, and I did not enter the school. That's the moment when I decided to think about being a wine grower, and I realized actually there were bad things like hailstorms and fire that I had been living as a kid. So I was really afraid of this. And then with my father, we also listed positive things. And at the end of this work, the positive side was bigger than the negative side. And then I said, okay, I'm going to try to do that. And I studied agronomy. I was lucky because my father allowed me to do that kind of school and he paid for the studies. And then I came back. So that was in the very early 90s.
How is study of agronomy maybe different from the study of viticulture?
I studied both.
Okay.
Agronomy. And then I had 1 year studying viticulture and winemaking.
And do you think that the study of agronomy has influenced the way you make wine?
Very much. Yeah. And probably it will influence me in the future due to climate change. Comparing to some colleagues, to me, this is a great motivation because the fact that we have to explore solutions in a way to solve new problems, that's exactly what I've been learning. I'm curious and I really like the idea that everything is changing. I'm conscious that it's a problem. I'm not saying it's a nice situation, but intellectually, to me, it's very interesting to build new solutions and to adapt to the moving situation.
It's obviously not easy to figure out the solutions, but having the education...
learn how to have the right questions and also create the solution. Not only list the existing solution, but imagine other solutions. So you don't watch behind, you watch in front of you. You have to imagine the future. And you need, of course, you need to know a few things about vine growing, physiology of the vineyards, and also climatical things, in a way to make sure that your solutions are all right.
I wonder if you can talk about an example of something that you're thinking about now or working on now that maybe your education in agronomy is...
I had a problem of frost in a vineyard. It's a young vine, and it was freezing nearly every year. So the first reaction was to say maybe it was a mistake to plant this land. But then I thought maybe I can plant small trees in a way to prevent the frost from arriving into the plant. But then I thought, okay, but before doing this, I have to understand how the air is moving in this land. Otherwise, if I plant the trees in the bad place, I will keep the frost instead of protecting my vineyard. So I contacted university. And we decided to make a big experiment. We've had like 60 captors thermometers mm-hmm. on the floor, higher. And then we've been, on a modélisé. Now we know exactly how the air is circulating in this vineyard. And we know we can determine a way to protect the vineyard. And it's not working at all the way I had imagined. So it was a good idea to do that. Maybe with Benjamin Bois from university, we are thinking of doing it again to check that this is repeating year after year, because we don't know, maybe it's moving. So we do it again this year, and mm-hmm. then I will plant.
I wonder if you could take us back to those years when you were having those conversations with your father mm-hmm. and you're finishing in university. Did you work closely with him after you left university, or did he sort of hand you the keys and you take over? How did that happen?
I made wine with him in 1991. Mm-hmm. So we've been working together like 4 months. I just observed him and obeyed to him. And then I went to Australia for 6 months because I wanted to see the wine industry. I wanted to see something very different. And I wanted to come back to Burgundy with a new eye, be able to criticize all the things we were doing. But to criticize, you have to be able to compare. Mm-hmm. So I've been to Australia, New Zealand. Then I came back 1992. I did the harvest again, and I started making experiments and putting a distance between what my father was doing and what I was doing.
Did you have ideals at that time in 1992 that you still believe in very strongly, or has your thought process changed a lot?
Something that hasn't changed is actually the reason why I am probably making Pinot Noir. It's the smell during fermentation. To me, this is just something I can't get bored with it. Fermenting Pinot Noir is amazing for me. So this is the same. But then what is new is that I wanted to find a way to put that in the bottle. Mm. So it took me a few years. And now my entry, first Pinot Noir, is that style of Pinot Noir with a lot of fruit. This is a reference to this very special moment when the tanks are fermenting.
I'm sure you can tell blind tasting your wines once they've been bottled and they're finished wines, but do you think just by the smell of fermenting Pinot Noir, you can tell where the grapes are from? Or do they all smell pretty similar, the fermentation?
Well, they are quite similar. If you consider only the aromas, they are quite similar. Mm-hmm. You know, it's this very, very fresh sherry and sometimes a little raspberries. So, but then if you allow me to taste,
then
maybe I'm able to.
This episode of In the Drink is sponsored by VS. For over 36 years, VS has been a leading importer and distributor of some of Italy's finest wines. Their philosophy is quality, history, and transparency, and they think that wine should always have a story to tell and should always represent its terroir to the fullest. You know, I've been working with VS at my restaurants for over 10 years, but I just found out what the acronym VIAS actually stands for, and I think it's pretty cool. It means Vitigni Italiani Autoctoni Selezionati, or Selected Italian Indigenous Grapes. So that means that the wines in their portfolio are wines made from native Italian grapes, and they're wines that clearly exhibit their terroir, local culture, and deep history. VS has over 76 unique brands imported to the U.S., including some of my favorites like the Produttore del Barbaresco, Berici, Salvioni, Castello di Rampola, and many others. So keep an eye out for that VS label on the back of a bottle of wine because it's the mark that something uniquely delicious is inside. And so what was your father, Henri Naudin, doing at that time that you wanted to change that was different? You said, I'm going to do things the Claire way.
Mm-hmm.
What was the Claire way? What was different?
The first thing was concerning the vine growing and especially the spraying and also the fact that we were using herbicides because my generation was very concerned with pollution and with the impact of this viticulture on the water and the atmosphere. So he was a bit shocked when I started to say that I wanted to decrease herbicides and maybe cultivate the soil again. Not because he loved chemistry, of course not. Just because he had lived a situation when he was young, when, you know, they were spending so many hours trying to get rid of grass. And also grass was a big competition with vineyards, so because they had a lot of grass, they had very small crop, and actually they were not really living on their work in the vines. He was afraid I would come back to this situation, and he thought I was really going a wrong direction. So I had to be very slow and make a lot of experiments, and yes, it was difficult for him to accept. Mm-hmm. But then, probably due to my winemaking diploma, he was impressed, and all I was doing in the cellar, he was accepting very easily. Even when I said I would stop racking the wines after malolactic fermentations, he was like saying, okay, you know what you are doing.
Wow.
You are the winemaker. Great. I've been lucky because I've been experimenting very early and exactly the way I wanted, and he was trusting me and following me.
I know that you prefer to use a spontaneous fermentation. You don't add yeast. I imagine he was adding yeast at some point. No, he never did add yeast.
No.
So because, you always had the good, strong yeast population.
His generation actually would sometimes do pied de cuve. You know, you cut a few grapes before harvest, you have them ferment, and then you spray this start in other tanks. But we both had the same way to see things. Why would you bring yeast if you don't bring any? It is fermenting. Why would you change it? It's very easy. So we don't change it. We use natural yeast. And I've been making wine for nearly 30 years now. And I've lived no situation where it would have been a problem to have natural yeast growing.
That's great.
The only situation when I can add yeast is sometimes like 2018, at the end of fermentation, due to many reasons. Some of the reds stopped, probably because the temperatures were quite high and maybe due to the high temperatures in the summer, maybe we had a lack of nitrogens in the juices, in the grapes. Actually, I don't have the explanations. Some friends have had troubles with the whites. Mm-hmm. My whites have been fermenting perfectly. Well, so in this case, if I have the choice between having a big increase of VA or adding yeast to make sure that it is fermenting and remain clean, then I would add some yeast.
I know that in Burgundy, and I think in all of France probably, there's a challenging inheritance law where usually the property is split up equally amongst all the siblings, right? Was it a big challenge for you to get your sisters to sell you their shares, or how?
So for the moment, actually, we did not share. So the vineyards of the family are in a GFA, Groupement Foncier Agricole. So there's a partnership. Okay, the vineyards belong to my sisters and I. Mm. And my father has the rent for it. That's how she can live. The question is, when my mother dies, either I rent to my sisters or I can also buy from them. In my case, it's quite easy because we are in the Haute-Côte area. So it's not so much money. Mm-hmm. And actually, I was 50 last year. Now,
happy birthday.
I'm yes, I'm nearly 51, actually. I'm starting to save money to be able to buy from my sisters.
Okay.
And I think that's the solution. You have to prepare it and have a lot of time to prepare it. And this way, you can keep the vines in the family.
Mm-hmm. But you do have some vineyards in Grand Cru, Echezo, for instance. And
the vineyards of the Echezo, I have myself one-third.
Okay.
And a partner has two-thirds. So I'm also in a situation where I can imagine maybe to buy from him.
Mm-hmm.
It depends whether his children will like to keep the vineyard or not. So this is something I have to think about.
Yes, an added level of challenge always to,
yes,
to think about.
Well, the thing is, imagine at some stage this man would like to sell the vineyard. I have to be able to buy it, otherwise I will lose it. So this will determine the price of the bottles.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the price of the bottle is high enough, then I can imagine being able to have money from the bank. And as long as I'm not 80, I can have money from the bank, maybe 70.
And so was it 1994 that you took over and your father
officially
sort of stepped away officially, or when was that?
No, he never stopped.
He never stopped. Okay.
Well, when he died.
Yeah.
But he was always here offering help if we needed.
Good.
And having advices or suggestions, but very respectful with the way I was working. So to him, spend 1 or 2 hours a day in the vineyards was like remaining, like existing. So we always kept him helping us like this. So there's no official time when you could say, this was Henri Naudin, this is Claire Naudin. It was a very gentle transition.
When did you start putting Claire Naudin on the labels? And how did that change?
Oh, not so much. No, it's not so old. Maybe 5 years. Anyway, due to my agent in Japan, Seiji. We have to thank Seiji. Because
Seiji.
He said, you have to help us. Our customers need to know whether it's a normal method or whether it's fermented without sulfur, which is Claire Naudin's method. And he said, the easier is to write it on the front label. Then we know. I had difficulties accepting this because to me, Claire Naudin is only one very little step inside many generations of wine growers and winemakers. So to me, it had no interest to write Claire Naudin. But on the other hand, he said, okay, but this is what you brought. This method, this is you. So to us, it's logical that you would sign the bottles. He won after 2 days, two years negotiations.
I love seeing your name on the label and explaining to our guests your theory and your
I
philosophy.
I hope it's helping you.
For sure.
Explaining.
And the previous label was Domaine Henri Naudin Ferrand.
This is the company name. So if you watch the bottles, even if you have Claire Naudin on the front label, you have Domaine Henri Naudin Ferrand on the back label.
And what's the Ferrand name come from?
It's my mother's name. So in Burgundy, usually when you have two names like that, Naudin, Ferrand, the second name is the name of the woman when she brings vines. It's a way to thank the family for giving vineyards and also get part of the reputation. In my case, it's not this. It's a funny explanation, actually. My father has the same name as my grandfather. Both are named Henri Naudin, were named Henri Naudin. So adding Ferrand allowed them to distinguish the two business. Mm-hmm. When my father started, he started very early. He started for himself, and my grandfather was making his own wines. And then my grandfather got older and gave his vineyards to my father. So that's only a question, an administrative question.
Yeah, on top of your way of making wine, one of the things that I think distinguishes your wines, and you alluded to it saying that you're one in a lineage of multiple generations, is the age of your vines. You seem to have very old vines. Mm. I wonder if you could talk about how you got these old vines. Were they just always part of the family's vines? I know you have some Aligoté, it's 100 years old.
And... Mm-hmm. Well, the oldest Aligoté, unfortunately, have died due to frost in 2016. Two of them have died, but I still have some. Mm. One is nearly, 85, mm-hmm. and all of them are more than 60. So were planted by my grandfather. So that's why I just decided to keep them. So it means at some stage you don't only consider the accounts, you consider the potential. To me, an old vine is the most precious thing I can have. It's like a genetic patrimoine potential. And also it's a whole history in itself. And last thing, of course, it's a very high quality potential because they have a big root development who allows them to have a very regular level of quality. Because if there's a lack of water, they can go and look for water below, deep. Same for food. They have bigger... The base, yes. They have,
the wood, the trunk, yeah.
It's a big storage of food as well, mm-hmm. of nutrients and plenty of things. That's why they are resistant to difficult situation. And at the end, okay, there is less fruit, but it's amazing balance and richness. So for all these reasons, when I arrived, my father wanted me to pull out these vineyards, and I said, no, please give me 5 years. I will make wine from them, and I hope I can make the proof to you that it's worth keeping them. That was only a feeling. Then I did it. We tasted together, and he said, okay, we won't be rich, but I understand what you mean.
I imagine there's an age where many people will pull up Aligoté because it's not as productive anymore.
And if you're going to keep it, 40, 50. So, of course, if you talk about 80, everybody is laughing at you.
Yeah. How much does the production level drop from 40 to 80 years? Is it half the production level or is it?
The production for Aligoté most often is around 70 hectoliters per hectare, and I'm rather 30.
Wow, less than half.
But it's worth it, yes. Really worth it.
I love all of your wines. Perhaps I drink the Aligoté most often, and we have them at my restaurants. They're so beautiful. I imagine that your father wasn't doing such an emphasis on Aligoté. You do two Aligoté bottlings, the Malon and the Clou 34?
Yes. He was blending all.
He was blending all.
Yes.
And how did you decide to separate the two bottlings?
When I said, give me a chance to prove that there's a big difference. That was 2000. Of course, they are pressed separately because the date of harvest is different. But I decided to make two blendings and ferment them separately and keep them separate until the end. So 2000. And then... 2001, for the first time, I fermented them without sulfur added. And then it was like a bump.
Wow.
It was an explosion of aromas, and also the taste was so different. Mm-hmm. Like not only you have acidity, but it's like salted. It's like a new dimension. And my father was crying when he tasted them. He was with his friend, Louis Clemencey, from the village. It was like my test. And I said, okay, you have to drink this. What do you think? And they just...
Wow.
These guys amazing. Don't talk that much.
Yes.
They will tell you, okay, it's good. Well, it's not so good. But they said nothing. They just cried. And I thought, okay, I will go on.
And how did you decide? How do you decide what grapes go into the Malon versus the Clou? Is that a vineyard selection? Is that a barrel selection?
All the old vines potentially go to the Clou. Mm-hmm. But then, before harvest, of course, I visit all the vines, I taste them, and I still keep the possibility to decide that this one is not the level. So I will put it in the other blending. Until the day of harvest, it can change. If you get, I don't know, botrytis at the end, or if maturation is a little disappointing, it's a choice I do every year for every vine.
So the idea for the Clou is to show the top potential, yes, perhaps, of Aligoté.
Yes, exactly.
It seems like it could be very age-worthy, too. Every time I drink Clou, I love it, but I'm also like, maybe I should have saved this a few more years. It always feels...
Yes, like, because actually that's what I like to do at home. Like, for the moment, I'm pouring Le Clou 2013. Mm-hmm. That was not so easy because it was so much botrytis. But it's an explosion of aromas. It's very, very surprising.
And I
think,
too.
Yes, I think it's a mistake actually to drink Aligoté so young. Mm-hmm. It's done like this in Burgundy too, but to me it's really a mistake. This grape has a potential for aging if you make it properly and if you don't go to a big, big crop.
Yeah. I just got my... offer from Wine MC Square with 6-liter bottles of Aligoté Le Clou.
I can't interfere. I don't have the power.
And I maybe you know of someone else who's bottling 6-liter of Aligoté, but I've never seen anyone do that. I imagine...
You must thank this man,
thank
Jean-Luc.
You, Jean-Luc.
Yeah, well, he motivated, because first when he told me about that. I said, you are crazy. But then I'm crazy too. No, it's the first year I said, what a job. Why am I doing this? But now I got used to it. And I, actually, when I do it, because it's a lot of time, I'm doing the bottles myself, of course,
wow,
ordering special corks, put the corks,
wow,
everything. But then I think to the people who will share this bottle. To me, that's the wonderful thing with a big bottle. It's to imagine that there will be so many people drinking the same moment and sharing a very special moment. So that's my motivation. So I keep doing it.
Wow. And I imagine that out of the 6-liter bottle, especially with a wine like Le Clou, you can age that for so long.
I've kept
30 years. I don't know.
I had kept some, and we drank them this summer for my 50th birthday. So we've drank the oldest, but now I'm keeping for my century anniversary.
You keep for your century, 50 more years.
Yes,
I love it. This episode of In the Drink is brought to you by 750.com. 750.com is the most important resource for beverage buyers. I use 750.com on a daily basis, not just because of the vast amount of products that are listed on the site. I mean, everything I could possibly want for my restaurants, Fausto and Lalu, are located on 750, but also because of how reliable that information is. For me, when I'm ordering something, I need to know that it's going to be there and the information on it is going to be accurate and true so that I can plan out my beverage program. So it's always so helpful to me to know that when I order something on 750, it's going to be the wine or the beer or the liquor that they say it's going to be there. It's the correct vintage. It's in stock. They know that it matters and makes a huge difference for buyers just like me and like you. So go to 750.com and open up an account today. Today's episode is brought to you by Melio, a digital payables platform made just for small businesses. If you're a small business and you deal with a bunch of different vendors, as I know I do at my restaurants, sometimes it can be hard to keep track of a ton of different invoices, all with different pay-by dates and different terms. Melio is one simple platform that allows you to centralize all of your invoices and pay them on a timely manner, making sure that you're never late for a payment, or sometimes even worse, pay too early. With Melio, sending payments and even requesting them is made simple and easy and can be done all in one local place. Visit gomelio.com and add your first bill to get started. You mentioned a few times that you use no sulfur during fermentation. Do you use sulfur at other times, like before bottling?
Yes.
And why is it so important to not use during fermentation, but okay during other times?
So sulfur has three properties. It is antioxidant. Mm-hmm. So if you use no sulfur, you have to protect. It can kill yeast and bacteria. Actually, bacteria are more sensitive than yeast, but if you add sulfur, you make a selection of the yeast, even natural yeast. So using no sulfur, you have many kind of yeast that are growing. You have to deal with it. But it's interesting. To me, it contributes to a richer expression of terroir. And then sulfur for the reds is also extracting the tannins and the color. We can talk about that if we talk about the reds later. So the fact that we ferment without yeast, probably that is explaining this very specific balance in these wines, because different yeast, more yeast, and also yeast are working differently. Because when they have sulfur, to them, it's like a problem. And if that's a problem, it's like a stress. So they behave differently. So to me, that's a good reason to ferment without sulfur added. And if you are like clean and have good grapes, you don't need it, actually. Then second thing is, if you can age without sulfur added, then you have more movements, either in a barrel or in a tank, and the wine can feed from its lees. And if the aging is long enough, you nearly have no lees at the end. So it means they are in the wine. So the wine is richer, is more stable. To me, this is interesting.
And the lees would protect maybe against oxidation.
Exactly.
So you don't need the antioxidant
characteristic. Yes. So you know that's sulfur. Very logical, all this. Yeah. But sometimes, for some reds, sometimes with whites, especially if you have a little sugar left, you might have a problem because as you add no sulfur, bacteria will ferment malic acid very early. Mm-hmm. Then they have no malic acid to eat and they need something to eat to survive. So they might eat sugar. And then it will be a competition between bacteria and yeast. Yeast don't like to work in these conditions. They stop fermenting. But then, so bacteria eat sugar, you have VA, and then as they are fighting, Brettanomyces try to develop. And that's how you can go a wrong direction, mm-hmm. in my mind. So that's why I'm adding a little sulfur when malolactic is done. But it's very small amount, and then I've noticed if I'm able to do that, then bacteria stop, yeast finish the sugars, and the wines remain, you know, like clean, and they have no sugar at the end, which I like.
And you said when malolactic is done, is that for reds and whites?
Yes. Well, for reds, it's very fast. Yeah. Malolactic more and more is starting at the start of alcoholic fermentation, and more it's finished either before pressing or in the 2 weeks after pressing.
Is that because of climate change, do you think? It's warmer during harvest time?
Yes, because we have less malic acid, mm-hmm. as it's warmer. Temperatures are higher. Everything is helping fermentations. And I don't know, maybe it's also a change of populations in my cellar. I'm not sure. I just can observe that all is a little faster.
I know that one of the changes you made to the cellar was moving everything towards gravity.
Yes.
What effect do you think that's had on the wines?
Very easy to say. Yeah. The first reds I've bottled after working this way, I was showing the wines in Paris with my agent, and the customers asked me whether I had brought aromas to the wines. So we were laughing so much, saying, well, it's not exactly my philosophy, you know? Because actually I have one very simple rule. If we work in the cellar, it mustn't smell like wine. Because if you have a nice smell of wine, it means aromas have left the wine. Oh. And they are lost for the bottle you will drink. So if you work gently enough, you don't lose aromas. And at the end, you have more aromas in the wine.
Wow.
Both for whites and
reds. How do you accomplish that?
We use, for example, we were blending the village and cru appellation this week, the reds. So we sent filtered air and pressed air at the top of the barrel. Then the wine is leaving the barrel through the brocro, the hole in the bottom, just over the lees. We go to a blending container, stainless steel, 10 hectoliters tank. Then we lift it up and we blend in the bottling tank, which is higher. So we use these containers to replace the pump. So we blend in this tank and then we bottle with gravity. So we don't need a pump.
And you think the pump will lose some aroma if you're pushing it through?
No, actually, some pumps can do a great job.
Mm.
Especially, it's called volumetric. There's no change of pressure in this kind of pump. So it is possible also to do it this way.
Yeah.
But it's so easy to use gravity.
It seems so impressive that you use gravity all the way throughout, even with bottling. That seems unique.
Well, using gravity, I don't know. It's so obvious to me. You know, I like simple things.
Yes.
Simple, efficient things. I will give you another example. For maturation, when I started, I wanted to be very precise for the tannins, for the phenolic maturation, etc. We were sending samples to university, making big analyses. And it was such an organization and the cost and everything. And then I discovered that I had all the device in my mouth because so that's the way I do it now. I just pick berries. So I visit my vineyards, I pick berries. I put all the seeds here and then the skins in some place. And then I chew the skins. If I have to spit the skins and I'm like this, okay, it's not good to harvest. When it's ready for harvest, I just swallow the skins I forget that I'm observing the skins. When I swallowed them, okay, maybe we can go and harvest. And then I watch the seeds and I check that most of them are brown.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my test. So imagine, I can do it without even thinking about it. And I'm not wrong.
I imagine that your experience at this point would be easier. Do you think if 20 years ago you told yourself, like, you don't need
well,
to
Well, I've
do
been
that.
Really learning about the tasting of the tannins, you know, with a few other wine growers. We had a coach. We've been tasting, thousands of samples. And this guy taught us how to classify the tannins and understand what was dry, what was green, what was, you know. That's how I learned. And then I had my own method.
It seems like everything you do is pragmatic and logical and not overcomplicating.
If there's a change to do it this way, then I like to do it this way. I really like the idea. Well, I'm not fond of technology. Mm-hmm. To me, technology is fun, but it makes you very fragile. And, you know, I'm restoring an old house in the vines. No water, no electricity. And I really want my children to learn how to live this way. Mm-hmm. You never know. And if you are able to live simply, you make sure you can always survive anyway. I don't know why this is so important for me, but it's like that.
Yes, I was going to ask you, where does this come from?
To the fact that when I was a kid, I saw big hailstorms mm-hmm. and big fires destroying the vineyards. And maybe to me, the idea to be resistant to things is in my body. I don't know. The more you need technology or things that are done by other people that sometimes are far from you, if you need something that is far, it means you need transport and you need energy for transport. So you have more conditions. If you do with what is here, the stone, the wood, the clay, the water, then okay, you just do it.
You said that you're doing tastings with some other growers. Are these, you have a group of Burgundian growers who you share similar ideas with, or are they from different
this
regions?
This group that was more than 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. But then mm-hmm. most of them went to a very technological way of making wine. And at some stage, tasting with them, I've discovered that what I was very often preferring were the wines without technology. So I said, okay, I was very glad that I could learn with you, but I think our ways are separating now. I'm going my own way and with as less intervention mm-hmm. as possible. I think that is my way.
I wonder if there's a next frontier for you. Is there something else you're trying to accomplish right now that you're working hard on?
We still have to improve in the vines. So unfortunately, I'm still using a little herbicides in the haute côte area because first, we could not afford the equipment to cultivate the soil, but also because we have a lot of stone and not a lot of earth. So we still have things to experiment to get rid of herbicides. And also, I want to get rid of sulfur and copper, if I can. So this year, we are experimenting in one vineyard. We will have no copper, no sulfur. We will have a soup of seaweed, les algues,
seaweed.
So this thing has been used in Switzerland for 3-4 years already, so I'm not the first one. We use the capacity of the surface seaweed to resist to hydric stress because this seaweed, they have water, then no water, then water, no water, due to the marée. The movement of the sea. And some people have discovered that this resistance to the stress could be transferred to other plants just by spraying a soup of these seaweeds. So I will do that because I have a vineyard that is very close to the house in the village. And I don't accept to spray sulfur. It is organic, but honestly, when you spray it in summer, it is not good for the smell, but not good to
inhale for the lungs. Yeah.
Yes.
And every conscientious grower I speak with seems that they have an interest in getting rid of copper or minimizing copper.
Yes.
Because it's something you can use for biodynamic wines or organic wines, mm-hmm. but it's a heavy metal that stays in the soil.
Right? Some colleagues keep telling me that living soil can do with it. So I wanted to explore another thing, but this is developed by young people in Lyon. They want to decontaminate the soils by growing grass and then getting rid of the grass. But my question is, okay, so you take the copper away from this vineyard, but then what do you do with the grass that has copper? So maybe you can do that at some stage, but it's not a long-term solution to me.
I wonder just if one of your wines I've never tried is the Echezo, a very fancy wine. I wonder if you could tell me how you approach making wine in such a prestigious place.
I don't have a specific method for the HSO, you know. I'm just very humble. The potential of this wine is in the grapes, because the grapes reflect their origins. So that's why I do nothing different, because, you know, it's not my problem. It's I trust the soil and the place. So I just interfere as less as the others. I try not to think, you know, because if you realize that you are doing with a chouzo, you get stressed and you might make mistakes.
So it's a responsibility.
Yes. So when we plunge, of course, the first plunging, usually I'm alone and it's like a special moment. It's like my récompense.
A treat. Yes.
And then, but then we try to be normal.
The fermentation of Echezo, it smells the same as Haute-Côte?
It's a little different because it's a wooden fermenter.
Okay.
It's like my private bath.
Yes.
So you also have, it's not a new one, but you have the smell of the wood anyway. As I said before, the smell.
The smell is the same.
I can't. Then now I have two wooden fermenter. Imagine you make me blind and you put me in the fermenter. I won't detect the difference, probably. The thing I will detect is the hate in the fermenter. Mm-hmm. And maybe I will know where I am. But the smell, no, I don't think it's so different. Except if there is a bad yeast or a bad bacteria growing, which I don't expect.
You've added something to my wine bucket list, is to come during fermentation just to smell your winery. I would love to do this.
What you have to do is taste with me a grape that has spent like minimum 5-6 days 1 meter below, because then you have enzymatic fermentation in the skins. And this has a taste of muscat. That's why you have roses aromas in the carbonic maceration. So you have bubbles, because this is a fermentation that is producing a little CO2, very little, but it is also smelling like muscat, rose, and I love doing that. That's what we can do when we first plunge. We dig and go and get these berries and just imagine the wine that it's going to make. It's my pleasure, you know. The way we plunge, it's an issue because we could die. We know we work in CO2 atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So I built a device we have a hole in the wall and a pump that is bringing air, fresh air. When we plunge, we go on like, we have grapes like here. So we need something giving oxygen to us. So this is dangerous. If someone decides to stop the pump, we die. So you never must forget this. But on the other hand, it's so central when you work with your whole body in the tank. I love it.
If I ever do this, I'm going to wear an oxygen mask with a tank in the back like a scuba diver.
No, what we scary. Do usually... No, it's not scary because we have our risk procedure. Okay. So there's always someone outside the tank checking that the air is arriving. And we have a ladder also to make sure we can get rid out of the tank easily. So nobody died in my place. We don't want to die.
One last thing to finish on. Is there something that you wish people would know about your wines that maybe I didn't ask you about?
Well. I have no recipe. Sometimes when I have new students visiting me, I can feel that they are a bit disappointed. I had one 2 years ago. Oh. It's a son of a colleague in Burgundy, and he wanted the recipe of Orchis. And I said, well, Orchis is like inside here, because it's nearly 95% of personal feeling. But I hope you will make your Orchis. You have to trust yourself, and first you have to dream of a wine you would like to make. Then you trust yourself, explore, be precise, work a lot, and hopefully you will do your wine, your Orchis, that will be even better than mine because it will be yours and it will correspond to you. And then your customers will be happy because it doesn't look like mine and like my other children's.
Mm-hmm. For you, it's personal. Wine should be a personal thing.
Yes, yes. Otherwise, it's something else. It's like rather industrial wines, which probably have to exist because the bad aspects in our wines is that they are changing due to pressure, temperature, seasons, and you can have a good surprise and sometimes you can be disappointed because you expect it to be so aromatic and it has decided to be a little shy. You have to accept this. So I can imagine that some customers or consumers just want to have exactly what they expect in the bottle, always. Then industry can provide this, and that's great. But then for other people who maybe are matured, they expect something else about wine. They are ready to bet, you know, and then if it's the right day and the right people, it's amazing. But sometimes it's not the right day.
Yeah.
You have to open something else.
Well, thank you so much for being a guest on the show. It's been such a pleasure to have you.
Thank you for listening to me and for your questions. It's not so often, well, it never happens that I have this kind of questions.
Oh,
thank you.
That's really good to hear.
This way, yes.
Thank you so much. Thank you again. So that's it for this episode and for this season of In the Drink. I want to give a big thanks to our extremely talented and creative producer, Jesmyn Molly. Big thanks also to Justin Wright for the ad music and Renny Lopez for the intro music. You can follow me on Instagram to find out when we'll be back for the next season. I'm at Joe Campanelli. And always feel free to send us any emails for suggestions, thoughts, or feedback. You can send those emails to inthedrinkpod@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next season.